My voice is loud, but maybe not loud enough. Can you hear me at the back there? Okay, excellent. And again, our guest today is Bill Berzins, and he is speaking about water scarcity in southern Alberta and who is managing this precious resource. Before we get to the question period, though, we do have a few announcements. I'd like to invite Trevor Page to come up and make a couple of announcements first.
Thank you, Luella. I've got three short announcements, and the first, you probably noticed a table on the outside of our door there to this meeting room, and we're pleased that Wendy Aitkins is here from the Galt Museum. She's the curator of the Galt Museum, and you might have seen that little sign outside there which says, "Your opinion counts." So all those that come to SAGPA, your opinion counts. That means all of you. And she has a little questionnaire outside with cards, and she wants to know what your opinion is about the exhibits, which you would like the Galt Museum to put on. So on your way out, please stop at the table and look at Wendy Aitkins' cards. The second one is, a couple of weeks ago, we had a presentation entitled Brain Myths, and that was by Patty Sorensen. And she basically talked about we're only using 10% of our brain, and what is the other 90% doing? Now, what she forgot to actually say is that anyone that would like to know what the other 90% of their brain is doing is welcome to contact her and go along to the little clinic that she has and sign up for some tests. And anyone that's interested, I brought her numbers along there. You can call her up directly. Thank you. You can call her up directly and sign yourself up to find out what the other 90% of your brain does. Thank you. And the last... The last announcement concerns the two special sessions which SAGPA has for the provincial election. Unlike other groups, we are devoting more time to it, but it has to be in the evenings at the library. So we have 2 hours of Lethbridge East on Monday, the 25th of February. And the Lethbridge West candidates will have 2 hours on the Tuesday, the 26th. And the main issues that emerge from those debates will then be debated once again live on Global TV on the 28th and 29th during the evening news hour program. Thank you.
Thank you, Trevor. And next week's meeting is going to be another fascinating one. The speaker will be Dr. Jason Myers, and he'll be speaking on challenges and opportunities in the manufacturing industry in Canada. Dr. Myers is the president of the Canadian Manufacturers and Exporters Association, which is Canada's largest industry and trade association. And he's also chair of the Canadian Manufacturing Coalition, representing 30 or more industry associations, which are voicing priority issues for the manufacturing sector in Canada. So that sounds very interesting as well. And remember, you can always go to www.sacpa.ca and listen to the live stream or the previous meetings, and also find out what's coming up. two other quick announcements as well. Since Bill is talking about, has talked about the Watershed Planning and Advisory Councils, there are two that are in our immediate area, the Old Man Watershed Council and the Milk River Watershed Council Canada. Both are having their annual general meetings soon. If you're interested in these issues and would like to learn more, the Old Man Watershed Council is having their AGM at the Lethbridge Lodge on March the 12th. And the Milk River Watershed Council Canada is having their annual general meeting on Tuesday, April 8th at the Milk River Civic Center. And now I'd like to invite Bill back. And we only have one mic today, so if you could please come to this microphone to ask your question. Remember to identify yourself and then address your question to Bill. Thank you. Who has the first question?
We'll start with the friendly questions, and if we run out of time, I'll be happy to answer your questions by mail.
I just like you need to come up here because
they're recording
it's being recorded.
Okay. Yeah.
Sorry about that.
State your name, not an alias.
No, yeah, name and serial number. My name is Barbara Lacey, and I'm on the Lethbridge City Council. And I wonder, Bill, what you feel is the most important thing that municipalities can do in coping with the water shortage, and what can they do to help in preserving water?
Yeah. Excellent question, and we've been working with a lot of communities to come up with some answers, so we have some very real suggestions and things that are already being done. First of all, on the use, the capture and use of water, like stormwater runoff. We used to think that the key to stormwater management is to shed it quickly into the river and prevent erosion. What we're learning now is, well, that's an important part of our hydrograph, so let's capture the stormwater, treat it, and use it, and seriously look at it for irrigation, fire flow, and other applications. So the way we design our communities and the bylaws we put in place around a new neighborhood, we need to contemplate more reuse of some of that water. Secondly, reuse of wastewater. Now, people have a problem with that. In San Diego, they branded a program, I think a couple dozen years ago, toilet to tap. Didn't quite work. So we've got to maybe back off that little sort of branding jam a little bit. But look at, yes, there are things we can do around wastewater reuse that will essentially allow us to draw less raw water from the river and keep the river water quality intact. So those are two areas specifically that we're seeing a lot of activity, which has changed the bylaws to enable recycle and reuse. Right now, the plumbing code allows the reuse of water in a building, so we could take wastewater or sewage, clean it, and then use it to flush a toilet. But policy prevents it, and perception prevents it. So I think that that's a couple things that communities could specifically do. And what we're seeing in some of the planned communities, the greenfield communities within, say, the Bow River Basin, where they're planning 2,000 homes, they're building those principles in right out of the gate. And then the final thing, I think, is examine more carefully incentives for good performance. So Alberta Environment has had discussions, for example, the city of Calgary has a big water license, and a lot of communities have said, well, just take away some of Calgary's and give it to us, which, you know, with 23 MLAs, that might be a hard thing for this city to do for a rural town or for the province to do. But what the Alberta Environment has talked about is, well, maybe we would take some of it back, and for those people that use it most efficiently, subsidize them. And those that don't use it very efficiently, they subsidize the efficient users. So look at a mechanism in terms of the fees that promote conservation and efficient use. So there's a couple things that I think are very important. But certainly it's hard to retrofit neighborhoods to recycle, reuse stormwater, wastewater. But we better start planning the new communities that way and structure accordingly.
Knut Peterson is the name. I wonder if you could fill us in on the groundwater situation concerned when there's drilling going on, oil drilling and gas drilling going on. How does that affect the or groundwater.
So that's a very good question, and in Alberta, not a loaded question. So I'll stop dancing quickly. We've looked at a number of those situations in which there have been impacts on groundwater attributed to drilling activity or exploration activity. I've spoken to groundwater experts and asked them that exact question. Is there a direct correlation? What they're telling me is that on the basis of scientific evidence, there doesn't seem to be a direct correlation between an impact on, say, spring water quality or well water quality and drilling or seismic activity. And it is unlikely. Okay? Now, that is contrary to a lot of anecdotal evidence that we hear about all the time. And in fact, when the Bow Council met with the Premier, while he was still pursuing this position, we spent probably an hour talking about what happened to his water well shortly after a seismic program done nearby. So the way I look at it is there's not a clear link between the activity that's been proven in the scientific literature. Okay, well, that's one part of the answer. There's enough anecdotal evidence that means we can't stop looking at that as a potential issue. And the reality is that if we have in the Paskapoo Formation 100,000 wells, well, that's water wells, maybe there's double that number of exploratory wells. Not all of them are necessarily completed to be intact for the next 100 to 200 years. So I think we need to start doing some more quantification of, are there some potential lurking issues there in the future? The problem is really complicated when you go to coal bed methane, because for some people in Alberta, they get their water well out of a coal bed methane formation. And when you take pretty good or marginal quality water out of coal bed methane, it might just be good enough to drink, but it might be high in total dissolved solids. But it will liberate some gas within your water well. So that's confusing the issue a bit. And some of the shallow wells that are completed for drinking water supply are subject to biological nutrients coming into the aquifer. So we're finding it difficult to come up with a definitive answer. So I think it's a complicated issue. I think that we have not done the scientifically conclusive work that's needed. And I think that's a priority for us, because right now we are starting to exploit groundwater. And if you look at the major aquifers around the world, and we did this about a year ago, we looked at the top five drinking water supplies in the world from groundwater, and they're faced with maybe in 30 to 100 years running out of water. So if we're not carefully managing our groundwater here, then let's hope that by accident we're not repeating the mistakes that have been made around the world. A chance that we might be repeating history a little bit. So I think it's an area that we need to do some more work.
My name is Patty Johnson. Is it on? Anyway. This is a domestic question. What are they doing and looking at for all the bottled water that we all buy in the stores? And we know to make it, I've heard it takes 5 liters for one little bottle of water. You know what I'm talking? Is there anything being done around that? Any sort of promotion to discourage? I know I've heard some, but discourage people from buying these bottles of water.
What's kind of humorous, I find, is that it's a domestic question. The most domestic questions in my household come from the fact I'm not even using 10% of my brain to solve a handyman problem. So right now, well, there we are. Yeah. So that number was 663. Oh, I'm sorry. That's mildly dyslexic. Right now, that's not an area of focus for the Water Council or the Bow River Basin Council. But, you know, it's also tied into the full part of our diet, because it's probably, that's the smallest water consumer of all. If you look at the fact that we make decisions about fresh produce from Chile and Peru in the middle of winter, and so if we have a liter of bottled water a day and it took five, well, that's 6 liters to consume the one. We're using 5,000 for everything else that we're consuming as well. So I think there's certainly a lot of backlash. It's not an area that we've focused on a lot in any of our work, but I think that that's an area that will continue to see a real pushback. But it's only part of a much bigger issue of what our quality or our lifestyle consumes in terms of water.
My name is Don Watson, and I sit on the Old Man Watershed Council. Bill, one of the slides that you presented in your presentation had a comparative review of the water pricing issue. And if I can glean one of the opportunities I think you indicated with regard to the low pricing in relation to the high pricing, and what kind of opportunity that might present for those of us here in southern Alberta. I think it was the 25 cent to that one right there. I think you alluded to an opportunity for us here in southern Alberta. Perhaps you could expand on that. Thank you.
Yeah, good question. And in fact, the Balzac water dilemma was really an example of where we went to assigning a value to solving the problem and came up with a pretty innovative solution. So in Balzac, the original proposal was pipeline the water from the Red Deer Basin to Balzac, use it for shopping, racetrack. Opponents of interbasin transfer said, well, that's just water for gambling. Right, which I guess in Balzac was a bad thing, but every other community that has a casino, we don't necessarily worry about the water for that. But anyway, that was an issue, a pressure point, obviously. But so what happened was the developers for Balzac had 13 trailer loads of rebar steel sitting idle, all the yellow iron, moving earth, and no water rights. So they had assigned a very significant premium or value to getting water entitlement. So they went to the Western Irrigation District, and the Western Irrigation District said, well, we've got a 20-kilometer or 50-kilometer, should know the number, stretch of canal that's leaking and evaporating water. So we'll pipeline that. The water we conserve and don't lose, we can now use it for that application. So it's an example of a conservation initiative that happened because it was possible for the municipal district of Rocky View to purchase a water right from the Western Irrigation District. So unless they enabled some commercial transaction, never would have got built. They'd still be, well, there'd be some bankrupt, you know, mall owners, and there'd be a lot of angst over it, and it's probably a political issue right now in the election, but that's an example of part of the opportunity. So where we can say, let's conserve water and use it for something else. An example would be when we wash gravel for the purpose of road building, we can either wash the gravel and treat the water and reuse it, or we can treat it a little bit and release it to the surface or to the groundwater. There might be opportunities for someone to say, well, let's treat the water, let's clean it and reuse it, and therefore we don't need to take as much water from the river, so we can use that for another purpose, like a development. And that developer would subsidize me putting in place a water treatment plant for $1 million or $2 million. So there's little, these sort of connections that start getting made if you can look at alternative uses of water. But you need an economic driver. You need somebody who's got to make a decision to put in a treatment works that they couldn't otherwise afford. So you need some mechanism. So it's either subsidies administered publicly, or you let a combination of subsidy and market come into play. And I think the answer is probably a portfolio that's carefully managed, so you don't end up profiteering for basic human necessity, but you allow a market to come up with innovative solutions of industry working together.
Sure, come on up, John. And then Cheryl.
Yes, thank you for your answer. Do you see an opportunity for a type of levy that could be used to incentivize, is that a word? Incentivize conservation measures? A tax.
My wife has criticized me for using the word incentivize, and I think I used it here, so I'm glad to see that it's a commonly accepted use or abuse of the language. So let me get this straight. So we're in the middle of an election. I'm supposed to know what I'm talking about water, and I could say yes to a water tax and get a phone call or two. But no, I think that what we should do, I wouldn't limit it actually to water. I would say, you know what, we've got, there's a whole suite of ecological values. We might think it's water because we need to get more water to allow the next 100,000 people to move into the basin. Or we might say it's a wetland area or some other a groundwater resource we need to protect. So I think that what we need to figure out a way is to divert some of the wealth that's being created towards some of these sustainability issues. And I don't want to call it a tax or a levy, but let's call it that we look at the priorities that we have and we allocate an appropriate amount to the future. That's pretty hard to do, though, because, you know, I think we saw the polls last night on the news, and it's something like 46% think healthcare is a crisis, 18% think education, 13% think it's environment. So environment just plummeted in the last 4 months in the public priorities. So it's going to be pretty hard for us to be talking about, well, we need to put money away so we can protect the future of our water supply when, you know, people are dying in waiting rooms. So we kind of, it's not, it doesn't lend itself, and that's part of why I sort of answered the question about are we doing a good job by saying, well, are we measuring? Well, we're not measuring in a way that allows us to make a trade-off. We know how long the average wait is in a waiting room. We know how long our average commute is. We know the average number of kids in a classroom, but we don't know, is the water going to be okay for 100 years?
My name's Cheryl Bradley, and one of the three goals of the three major goals of the Water for Life strategy is healthy aquatic ecosystems. And you and I both know, Bill, from our work on water advisory councils, that we have some pretty stressed rivers in southern Alberta that could use more water. I'm looking for your views on how we would somehow get some of that water that's traded in a market, enough of it, into our rivers to protect ecosystems. My understanding right now is that only the government can hold an allocation for in-stream purposes. You talk about a water conservation trust that I would assume would be a place where if you participated in a market, you could hold those, but I don't think that's possible in Alberta right now. But I just like your views on how we move towards that goal of healthy aquatic ecosystems in Alberta, because we haven't got very far at all in the last 5 years.
Maybe it's reassuring, maybe not, but there are some of us in our businesses that are trying to structure projects to achieve exactly that. So any of the projects that I get involved with, for example, I'll look at, okay, my stakeholder community includes the ecology. So if I'm going to do something around water use, I'm going to have to carve off some benefit for the ecology. And I don't know what that is yet, but it might be a higher treatment standard, or only using a portion of an allocation, or designing the raw water capture and storage so that it enhances the river upon return, not detracts. So there are opportunities to do that. When you transfer a license, as you know, the government can withhold 10% for conservation easement. We thought there still needs to be another mechanism. That's why we created the Water Conservation Trust, because there are some companies that would rather get the PR and know that the water was being put into a conservation trust than just back into a general account for redistribution in some to-be-determined manner. Like, there are companies that would rather say, no, we want to get some mileage out of it, and we want this to go specifically for conservation. But I know the debate in the oil industry with some of the groundwater allocations out around Alberta is, okay, if I conserve water, then I lose that right forever and get nothing for it necessarily. They toyed with the idea of allocating water to a trust, but then the concern is the reaction they might get next time they seek an approval on a project. So there's some angst around conservation for the purpose of protection of ecology. So that's why the trust still has some work to do and some test cases to run around whether we could truly allocate it for a long-term ecological purpose and not just conserve and return to general management. Because I think you need the visibility too. Like, you really should have an account somewhere that says, here's the conserved holdbacks and here's how we measure whether that's been good, bad, or indifferent. The problem is we don't attach a lot of value to the ecological values. So we don't really say, yeah, another cubic meter a second in the river is good for ecology, and that's worth something to us over the next 100 years. So we've got to find a way to close the loop, essentially, on the value proposition around that water for conservation. But underwater for life, that's probably the area that I think we spent the least money on. Underwater for life is ecological and healthy ecological systems, and we better get there very quickly.
I'm Bev Mendel-Atherstone. Thank you very much. I have to say that my dad was a brilliant engineer, so I'm used to brilliant engineers. thank you for the segue from your last topic to mine. I'm very concerned about the riparian environments and was very distressed to hear that you're saying that it would take 2-3 generations, maybe 100 years, before the riparian environments along the edge of the rivers would be restored. When I talked to Dr. Stuart Rood, he mentioned that the only way that we can really get the antidepressants, antibiotics, and hormones out of our water system, our river system, our sewage system, is through the riparian environment. This was confirmed when I went down to our water treatment plant. They cannot take those out through filtration or any chemical additives. So I think that's your answer as to why we want to conserve the ecosystems and rebuild them. And I wonder how long it would take to rebuild the riparian environments along the waterways if we had the political will.
The picture that you see here is in the Ghost Watershed, within the Ghost Watershed Management Area. And this is one of the protected areas in our watershed. So it kind of looks like a recreational or off-highway vehicle playground, doesn't it? So this, if you went to Northern Systems back in the early days of the pipeline work, and when they tracked vehicles across the permafrost, and that would remain so for hundreds of years, perhaps never be restored. I think the jury's still out on some of these high mountain watersheds, if they would ever be restored to a natural function. This watershed produces 5 times the total solids loading to the river that the Elbow watershed does. And we all think the Elbow was developed. So we have a pristine mountain watershed that's behaving like one of our worst, run-amok development watersheds, so to speak. So I think it's an issue that we will face with pine beetle, reduction in forest cover, continued use and development in the headwaters. And I think that it is a question of literally many generations. If we go to engineered systems, as brilliant as engineers are, and the consensus appears to be, that even the engineered systems will not mimic or replace many of the natural functions. And so in Alberta, we don't have a long track record of how our restoration projects behave over tens of years. So I think we need to kind of look at how do we better control the access. And it is a long-term issue. It's definitely many generations. And unfortunately, we're just going to have to, you know, bite the bullet today and assume that we'll make some progress.
Thank you, Mel. I have too many questions here for you, so you may have to be with me after the show. But each household, I put it in the first system for farmers. And with a gravity system from the Ridge Reservoir down to New Dayton. And we planned it so that each farm could have one, in one day they could have a 1,440 gallons. In other words, there was a restrictor on their pipe that gave them a gallon per minute per farm. And that worked very well until somebody wanted more for a feedlot. Now, that could be done because we did it and it worked well. And it was very uncostly. It was all gravity. There was no power involved. So what are they doing in this respect in Denmark, Holland, and Germany? And each household and business could have its own built-in holding tank at 1 gallon per minute per day. I wanted to know what you think about the modification that's being done in North Dakota to transfer the Missouri River into the Red River that flows into Winnipeg.
Okay, we're getting short on time, so you have 2 questions there. One is about the gallons.
And the other
is about the Missouri River.
Yeah.
Can you go with those to start?
I can, and what will I do with each other?
So you'll have to talk with them afterwards. Well, you stay up here, though.
I'll
have a supplemental. Yeah.
Okay.
Well, and I'll we'll get together afterwards.
Yeah.
I'll answer all your other questions.
Thanks.
Great.
Yep.
Because I need a hand. I fall now at this thing, so I know I
should. Oh, we don't want
that
to do that again. That's why
I saw that man fall here.
So what we are doing in some of the new community plans, they're looking at cisterns for the purpose of on-site water storage and also fire flows. So we are now starting to, in some of the new communities and estates, plan for storage of water. And then, so the, regarding the cisterns, we're actually starting to look and to use more of that. The situation on the Red Deer is an international issue, and I'm familiar with it, or on the Red River, rather. I'm familiar with it, but not expert enough to render an opinion. Is it okay if I have one question like that in a Q&A rather than make something up? But we can talk about that afterward. I went to a specialty conference on it, but it's very complex.
80% or 90%?
It's debatable if I'm up to 10 sometimes, so...
Our time is up. We'll take one last question. Is that all right?
My name is Jürgen Borchers, and I was wondering if there's any legislative initiative to norm the industry to supply water-efficient supplies for home use, like water-efficient toilets.
And maybe you know the answer better in Lethbridge. I know in Calgary there are preferred suppliers and rebate programs available. And I think it's the city administrators as well as the manufacturers, and they would allow you to get a rebate for the purchase of a low-flow fixture or toilet. I looked at that. My brother lives in Invermere, and I looked at whether we could introduce a program like that in Invermere, and, you know, we've had some discussions with the manufacturer about doing that. So there are some programs available, and that's another example of something that can be done at the individual homeowner scale. What was interesting was about a year ago, we did a program on wild rose about conservation at the home level. And then a lot of people phoned in and complained that they used to have washing machines that would take the rinse cycle, park it, and use it in the wash cycle. And you can't get that apparently anymore. It's really kind of interesting, right? Because it's sort of like what's old is new again. And we either do that with small cisterns and storage in the individual home, or we look at new generation of products that would allow us to do that.
Well, I'd sure like to thank Bill Berzins for coming today. He made some accommodations in his schedule to accommodate us. I got an email today that was timed 4:37 a.m. So thank you very much, and as Bill said, we can get his PowerPoint presentation from him by emailing him. I have his email address. Maybe I will pass that on to Trevor Page, and if anyone wants this PowerPoint, they can get it. So thank you very much for coming. We'll see you next week.
Good job, Will.
Thanks, Rob.
Nice to see you again.
Yeah.